This episode of Registry Matters is brought to you by our patrons. Thank you for your continued loyalty and support.
Y'all ready? One, two, three.
Recording live from FYP Studios, Houston!
This is the Registry Matters podcast. Oh, and it's episode 270, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct.
All right. Well, good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing awesome.
We don't ever record together. Where are we?
I'm not sure.
We are recording to a massive, large audience at the Houston Marriott near Hobby Airport in Houston, Texas, which would be the Houston Lobby Airport, right? And so we've had, well, we just have tomorrow left for the conference. We are at the NARSAW conference, and we are, again, sitting in front of a vast, large audience of hundreds of people.
How did you pack them all in here?
Standing room only, and they have to alternate breathing so that there's enough room for everybody to buffer and have space as they go back and forth.
It has to be like 200, right?
Exactly 200. Do you have an agenda for this evening?
Not really, but we do have a couple of topics.
Do you want to... We'll dive right in. Tell me, you have something that you think is an amazing thing that has happened in Arkansas?
Arizona.
Close enough. AR, both the same.
Really?
Sure. Because, you know, I said somebody out in the lobby, I said, Larry wants to talk about something from that the governor vetoed something in Arkansas. And they were like, Sanders? I was like, oh, no, it's not Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Never mind. Now I don't know anything. So Arizona?
Arizona.
Okay. What happened?
Well, I didn't do a lot of research because it's relatively new, but a bill that would have enlarged the public register to include level one offenders was vetoed by Governor Katie Hobbs.
Katie Hobbs. Do you know anything about the bill at all?
Well, it was going to expand the public reach. The people already registered, but the level ones, if I understood it, are not publicly listed. So this was going to take the extraordinary step of adding another layer of people to the public website.
I see. Okay, so the level ones in Arizona don't currently list. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I was understanding from the post I was reading, that this would have changed Arizona to include level ones to be publicly visible. And that was an extraordinary gutsy move to veto something that passed the legislature.
Why would it be gutsy?
Well, does anybody remember the name Ketanji Brown Jackson?
I believe I've heard of her, possibly a lower level court justice.
Yeah, she was a district judge, and she was nominated for the U.S. Supreme Court. And she had shown compassion as a district judge in sentencing people convicted of PFR type offenses in the federal system. And that was used against her to say that she was not fit to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Would you say she was kind of crucified for it?
That would be an understatement.
And so was it like, what's the guy from, is it Illinois? I can't think of his name.
Missouri.
Missouri, what's his name?
Josh Hawley, right? Yes.
So Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, anybody else?
Our favorite from South Carolina.
That would be Lindsey Graham.
That'd be correct.
Okay, so they beat the crap out of her for, I kind of remember the details. Can you fill in the gaps?
Well, it was because of downward departures in the sentencing, because she was actually listening to the defense attorney's arguments saying why they should be sentenced less harshly than the U.S. attorney recommended. And we can't have that because these people need to be in prison, according to those senators.
I'm trying to remember back. What percentage of the hearings would you say were devoted to these downward departures?
I don't remember, but
I think it was like half.
It was a lot of time spent talking about it. It was an extraordinary amount of time.
And we're using that as a parallel to the governor of Arizona vetoing. So the representative body, the legislature, voted in a bill to present to the governor to be signed into law that was going to make things worser for PFRs. And
correct.
She vetoed it.
That is correct. She all but sealed her doom for any future higher office if she wants to run, because that would be a perfect thing to crucify her with, is that she is pro-sex offender. Look at her opportunity. She could have protected the citizens of Arizona. She chose not to. She chose to side with the criminals and the god-awful criminals that do ugly things to our children, and she's letting them hide, and that is wrong, and she should never be rewarded with any other office, and maybe they'll even use it against her in a re-election campaign. But beyond that, I don't know the system in Arizona, and we don't have anybody I can call on real quickly, but if their legislature is still in session, and I don't know that they are, and I don't know that they're not, but if they are in session, and if I'm the leader of the Republicans, which is the majority party in the legislature, I'm going to ask for an override of that bill. And I'm going to force every Democrat in the Democratic side of the aisle to vote once again to protect the children or to uphold the governor. And when that vote is taken, that is going to provide our side, and I'm saying that pejoratively because I'm not a Republican, but that's going to provide our side with fodder in the next election cycle, because they not only got one chance, they got two chances. And on the second chance, they resorted to partisan party politics rather than protecting our children. And I'm going to use that, and that's likely what they would do if they're still in session, and I apologize for hitting the table. But they are going to do that if they have the opportunity. But I don't know that they have the opportunity because they may have already adjourned.
Okay. Does anybody want to ask a question about this before we move on? Yes, sir, you in the back amongst the 150 other breathing people.
Will this matter for Governor Hobbs, even though she just got reelected last year, in 3 years?
Well, this was her first election, if I remember right.
Yeah, she was elected here in 2022.
Yeah, but I'm saying she didn't get reelected. This was her first election.
So bring it up in 3 years from now? Or is that going to be old news?
No, I would suspect this would come up. I mean, when you're depending on her poll numbers, if she's at 62% approval, they may not be able to bring her down. But if she's at 51% approval, this could be a very critical veto.
Would you think that this has anything to do with her being a first time in her first term? I don't know what her political history is, but does this seem like a naive position?
I would say it's a courageous position. I don't think it's naive. When you rise to the level of being a governor and you can master that process of being elected, you're not naive very often. So I think she just said this is the right thing to do. She was compelled by the arguments that were made. Our Arizona people were very good at arguing and putting forth reasons why it should be vetoed. And I have always pontificated, if you let something get to the chief executive, they're going to sign it. To my knowledge, this is the first time a chief executive has vetoed anything.
So we have the first incident of you are wrong.
Well, I wouldn't say it's the first, but politically speaking, this is a risky move, not only for her, but for every member of the Democratic caucus. It was solid Republican unity was in favor of it. And most Democrats were probably in favor of it, but for whatever reason, they chose to vote against it. But it passed anyway because they're in the minority. But now they're faced with, you have to have a supermajority to override. And if I'm the Republican leadership, I'm going to force you to vote a second time if I can. So I can have you on record and I can say, not only you had one chance, you had two chances and you still did the wrong thing. You didn't protect our children. And if I can think of that, I can assure you they can think of that.
Anything else? I will move along. Go ahead.
Yeah, I can't think of anything else, but anybody else have any questions? There's 150 people here that are always wanting to ask questions.
Somebody asked if we could cover the story of why is it FYP Studios? And gosh, we could possibly do some impromptu theater. Possibly. I need someone to be a very, 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 very disgruntled neighbor. Would you please be a very disgruntled neighbor? You know the story, don't you?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm at home. I'm watching some television. I'm hanging out. I'm just being chilled out. And I need you to come knock on the door. And we're going to have a little conversation. You need to ask me who lives here. You don't know this story?
No, I don't think I do.
Oh, my God. Who knows this story? I need someone that knows the story. All right, but I need you to come up here. I know you're not afraid to come up. You're my disgruntled neighbor, and this will be great.
Well, no, this is a long walk from the back. A long walk from the back of the room. She's just now coming down the aisle.
You knock on almost stomp your foot. Oh, Yes, good evening. Hello?
Yes, who lives here?
I'm sorry, what?
Who lives here?
Okay, so, well...
I need to come in.
What?
I need to come in. I need to see who lives here.
You need to see who lives here.
Yes, I need to check out your place.
Okay, so, with that as the premise, you have to think in your brain, in your noodle, you have to think of the letters F-Y-P. I'm not going to tell you the answer. Not going to tell you. But what is your reply? Just think for a moment amongst yourselves. I can hear the gears creaking together. I can hear the bowling alley pins crunching. Does anybody have a guess? And raise your hand if you do. You already know. If you know, if you're a first-time listener and you don't know, let me know. Who are those people that don't know? Like, flat out, you've never heard it. Shut up, you know. Okay.
I'm representing a group of us.
People?
Yes.
Okay, well, yes. So far that I can tell, everyone here is a people.
For your protection.
Yes, that would be one of them, for your protection. Not right, sir. No.
Fine young?
Huh?
Fine young?
Fine young people that has been presented by someone. Anybody want to take a guess? You, sir? Guess?
Up
yours? Huh?
Up
yours? Well, yes, in a sense, but that doesn't include F and Y.
Oh.
Okay? So the letters, the initials. Anyway, so there's your answer. We have been talking about this quite a bit. Now, Larry, why is this, we did it as a joke when it started. I don't even remember how it started, but why is that significant as the answer to this question?
Why is it significant? Because there are people who insist they have a right to know. And I say, well, where does that right come from? If you knock at a person's door, what right do you have to know who's behind that door? Well, they can't tell me what right they have to know. Well, if they don't have that right and a person knocks at your door and demands information they don't have a right to know, what would you say to them? Would it be very kind and compassionate, or would it be something a little bit more aggressive?
Now, I suppose depending on how the person comes to the door, maybe you've already had some level of interaction with them. Maybe you would be somewhat more cordial. But if someone just storms up to the door and knocks the crap out of it, scares you, and they go, I have a right to know who lives here. I'm sorry, do you actually have that right? Could you please let me know where in either the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, any of the additional amendments, or anything that the legislature has signed into law that says you have a right to know? Right?
So if you don't have a right to know it and a person is bugging you, what would you say to them that would be somewhat less than polite that would start with F?
Pretty aggressive even. Pretty aggressive.
Colorful
adjectives. Perhaps someone cuts you off as you're driving to work and you can only articulate something from inside the car with
the windows closed.
Sounds possibly like duck. I'm with you. Okay. Larry, I have a topic.
Okay.
I have been speaking to a handful of people at the conference, and the way that I'm kind of laying it out is this big circle, and I would kind of like you to, as my mentor on all of this bullshit, I would like you to critique my circle of life. So the registry is a civil regulatory scheme, and for a civil regulatory scheme to be considered punitive, it would have to, the Supreme Court would use the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez 7 arguments or tests to see if a civil regulatory scheme is punitive. If it is punitive, it can no longer be a civil regulatory scheme. It would have to be considered punishment. So they would use those tests. Now, the one that we would like to focus on is disabilities and restraints. Does it impose disabilities and restraints on the individuals that are subjected to the civil regulatory scheme? Things like residency restrictions. Does this impose any level of disability and restraint? And if it does, then it can't be a civil regulatory scheme. It would have to be considered punitive, which would lead us all the way back up to the registry is a civil regulatory scheme. And we would then continue to kind of go around in circles. How did I do?
You did amazing.
All right. Well, then we can move on to the next subject.
How did you remember Kennedy Mendoza Martinez in the seven?
If we looked up how many times that has been used on the podcast in 269 previous episodes, it's probably 100 at least.
So, but that is correct. In 1963, the U.S. Supreme Court, in another case called Kennedy versus Mendoza Martinez, ruled that regardless of being labeled civil and regulatory, the legislature can label anything any way they would like. That's their prerogative. They can make any declaration they would like. That's their prerogative. They can issue any finding they would like. That's their prerogative. But for it to fit constitutional test, it has to pass those seven tests. And they didn't give enough guidance, but they gave a lot of guidance in terms of how to weight the seven. No particular weighting. And each time a challenge is made, we fail in developing the case in the lower courts to show what I think is the most critical of the seven, which is, does it impose any disabilities or restraints? In 2003, when they made their landmark decision in Smith versus Doe, there were virtually no disabilities or restraints that were a part of that requirement in Alaska. It was just annoying. You had to fill out a form, you had to return it by mail, and you wished you didn't have to do it. But you didn't have any obligations beyond that. But that was version one. There have been many iterations pending and passed since then, and now there are a number of disabilities restraints, particular in the southern United States, but not just the south. And now we have a different registry than existed when the last time the Supreme Court reviewed it. In my view, I'll say I don't think they got it wrong in 2003. I think they got it right in 2003. Despite all the lawyers that come here and say that they got it wrong. I don't see the disabilities or restraints. I don't see that it failed the test as it existed then. But now things have changed. So we have to distinguish the registry that exists today. We have to, rather than moving for summary judgment, we have to put on evidence, we have to have experts, we have to force the case to trial, and we have to prove that the registry as it exists now is punitive, and here's why. And we haven't been very good at doing that. And there were several questions. So who wants to ask a question?
I just want to toss in, we reference this state all the time as something. Can you craft what would look like a constitutional non-disabilities and restraint registry? I believe that we talk about a state kind of up in the Northeast.
We do talk about states, particular Vermont, but there are others where the registry imposes virtually no restraints. In Vermont, you have to mail in a form once a year. You never have to go see the police.
Residency restrictions?
None.
Even for the worst of the worst?
For the worst of the worst.
And so pictures on websites?
Some pictures on websites. No
SVP kind of people?
No physical addresses, just city and state. So it'll say Burlington, Vermont.
License plates?
No.
Internet identifiers?
Not on the website. I think they might be collecting those now. I'm not even sure about that. But a very, very minor inconvenience on the grand scheme of things. I would rather it not exist, but it's very insignificant compared to if you live in Florida or Mississippi or if you live in Louisiana or Illinois. I mean, I can go on and on. But in Vermont and some other states, the registry is probably still a civil regulatory scheme.
You, sir. Just first name, but you can even lie, but... Just
John in Florida, and I'll tell you what, it ain't like that no more.
That's true.
We got 52 things. We got
52?
52, that's
what I'm saying. Oh, okay. Georgia was 21 while I was on supervision.
Yeah. And they keep adding to it.
And so you guys have, you have a license identifier, and at the current, it's pretty, I don't want to say it's benign. I don't want to diminish it that much, but it's a very small font and it's just a code.
Some people would actually say that if you're a predator.
Oh.
What would be a tier 3. States,
okay.
You have a tier system in Florida. It says sexual predator in fairly decent sized letters.
You have to give them every email address you have.
Every email address.
This includes any work email addresses that you may have. I need you to speak louder.
Every internet identifier, including apps and all your email. emails and all your phone numbers, everything.
Description and serial number of every vehicle.
I was going in there next, yeah.
Anybody that lives with you owns.
Or visits.
Any trailer, boat trailer, utility trailer, anything like that you have to have that registered. Somebody comes to stay at your house on vacation, which happens quite often in Florida for a week, you got to register there. Any rental car.
Boat. Motorcycles.
Okay. Anything.
One-wheel scooter?
Yeah.
There are very rural counties in Florida that people, they've had sweeps, arrested 67 people in Cook County for having an old beat-up car on blocks out in the yard that didn't even have a motor or wheels. And because they didn't register it, they violated them.
Would you consider those to be disabilities and restraints?
I think they're very clearly disabilities and restraints.
Mike, you had a question?
Yes. How exactly does that work with Mendoza and Martinez? Do they have to prove all seven of them? Do they have to prove one? Exactly what makes it go one way or the other?
That was what I was saying. The Supreme Court wasn't really clear in terms of how many of the seven. They left a little bit of latitude there and how to weight each of the seven. But at the end of the weighting, the way I see what the guidance they did give is that the court should determine that the balance weighs in favor of one side or the other. When I look at the seven, I focus on disabilities restraints because to me, that's the most egregious. Whether it's excessive or not, I don't care if I can win on disabilities restraints. So I'm going to focus all my ammunition, if I'm the chief architect of litigation, on where I think the seven is going to be the most compelling. In my mind, whether I'm right or wrong, I believe that if you're taking away people's liberties, if they put their hand on that Bible when they took their oath and they're serious about protecting the constitutional liberties, that you're really going to be most concerned about the deprivation of liberties. When you can't travel freely, you can't associate freely, and some basic rights that you have that are deeply ingrained, I suppose, in the American Constitution. So that's where I go of the seven. There's one of them that nobody even understands. The courts don't understand it. There's one of the seven is whether it requires the proof of scienter, S-C-I-E-N-T-E-R. That's legal jargon. And what it means is whether the person had knowledge of what they were doing. And I think it requires scienter related to the registry itself. A lot of legal beagles think that the scienter required to was whether or not the original conviction that subjected you to registration required scienter. I don't believe that's the case. I believe that they're looking at if the registry to be convicted of violating the registry, if you have to knowingly have an obligation to register, that's the scienter they're talking about. So even legal professionals disagree, including judges, about what that means. But most of the time, that seven is basically ignored. Since nobody understands it, they ignore it. Focus on the disabilities of restraints. Build your case around that. Go in with powerful ammunition of a litany of disabilities of fundamental rights that you're being restrained without any due process of law. And don't expect that the state's going to just stipulate to these violations. You're going to have to prove them. And everybody files a motion for summary judgment. Because it's a quick way to a resolution, and they haven't built the case below, and we lose every time.
Now, if we were to compare the miscellaneous states to each other, it would be a tough race because there are some that are just about as bad as Florida. But for the sake of this conversation, we'll say that Florida is the worst. So since they're at the top of the scale, did they give up and stop there?
What do you mean? Do they give up?
Have they tried to make it worse?
Who's tried to make it worse?
Florida.
Well, they make it worse every legislative session. There's bills every session that they have to fight down there. They go crazy with new legislation every year.
But they're already the worst. Why would they keep making it worse, sir?
Well, because there are the victims' rights organizations who never are satisfied. You can look at anything that where their victims advocates, whether it be drunk driving, mothers against drunk driving, whatever. You can show statistics that you've reduced drunk driving by 70% over the last 30 years, that it doesn't matter. There's still too much. So regardless of how well the registry works or doesn't work, and locking people up works or doesn't work, they're never going to be satisfied, because if they said, well, we've done what we need to do, let's go ahead and stop soliciting donations, we're finished, let's shut down. What organization do you know that has done that, saying, well, we've achieved our objectives, let's disband? Can anybody think of anyone? Any organization that said, we've achieved our objectives, let's go ahead and close up?
I'm totally baiting you onto that one, because I don't want anyone in the room to get complacent that I personally was fortunate enough to, I dodged, weave all these different situations. I was terminated from probation early, and then I was removed from the registry, and I got the hell out of Dodge. However, they could, next legislative session, they could have pulled me back in. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's a civil regulatory scheme.
Civil regulatory scheme that doesn't impose disabilities and restraints.
Correct.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we're clear on this whole circle of life, that it's a civil regulatory scheme similar to a driver's license. That's also a civil regulatory scheme. And every year or every handful of years, they change driver's license requirements. Maybe this year you can have, somebody may be impaired in one eye. Maybe next year you can't drive anymore if you are impaired in one eye. Maybe they decide that. And on, because it's a civil regulatory scheme, you don't have a right to drive. So I'm really, really deeply entrenched on this whole circle of life thing. And because Florida's the worst, they've given up, right? No, they have not given up. That means your state, your state, your state, your state, your state could continue and make things worse. Even if you're in the best of them and you're up somewhere where they don't have a lot of these requirements and all that stuff.
We get that question all the time. Why don't you recommend states? FYP gets that mail all the time. Why don't we recommend states? Because the laws are not carved in concrete. They can change. There was a time when Alabama, which I think is the worst state, I think Alabama's worse than Florida. But there was a time when Alabama wasn't very bad. There was a time when Alabama was a pretty kickback place to be registered. It changed when Bob Bentley became governor. But there was a time. So you can go to Vermont, and if Vermont has recorded dozens of people moving there, and they tell them, well, we came here because it ain't that bad, and pretty bad down there in Mississippi, it's not too long that makes it so that information makes it to Montpelier, that we've got all these people coming here because we're lax. And do you think that they want people that are on the registry to come pouring into Vermont? Not too many states want that.
So it's almost a self-preservation of not ruining it for the other people that are in that state to make sure there's no mass caravan of U-Hauls from everyone moving to that state?
That is correct. We don't make those recommendations for that very reason. We feel like we would hurt the people that are already in those states.
I got it. Do you have anything that you want to bring up, Larry?
Well, how's the conference been going up?
Oh,
I've not been able to participate.
You've been up in your room laid up, haven't you?
No, but I've been distracted by many factors that were not anticipated here.
Did you bring your shower head?
I did not bring that.
There's literally an episode back in our history where the image for the podcast was of the shower head. Do you want to tell me what's up with the shower head, Larry?
I'm going to take a poll and prove you that you're wrong about this.
Yes, please.
I will guarantee you that once I explain to people why I take a shower head, and I ask how many people carry them, we're going to get the same answer.
So please, the audience, if you would give me a show of hands.
No, let me tell the story first.
Oh, okay.
So I take the shower head because in this conservation world that we're in now, we have to conserve water because I think the water we're using now is the same water that ran through I think the Egyptians used it a long time ago. I think it's relatively a closed environmental system. It's the same water that was used 1,000, 2,000 years ago. But some people think that water is a non-renewable resource. But anyway, so all these large buildings like hotels are putting in massively reduced flow restrictors. So you get this little trickle of water and you're trying to get the soap out of your head and nothing is powerful enough to rinse out your hair. So when I go to a hotel, I have my own shower head, and I just take their junky thing off and put on a real shower head that lets water come through.
Hold on. So in your luggage, you have a shower head.
A shower head.
And do you levitate? Do you just unscrew it with your fingers?
Oh, no. What you do is you carry the shower head, you carry a small set of channel locks, and you carry the Teflon tape, and you remove their shower head very professionally, and you put your shower head on, and you have all the water pressure you want, and then you replace it at the end of your stay. And when I go to the TSA, they look at me like I'm crazy, and I ask them, well, doesn't everyone have a shower head and a pair of channel locks? And they shake their head. Who carries a shower head and channel locks with them?
Show of hands. Anybody here? Hang on. Let me count.
They have channel locks.
But you didn't fly. You have them in your car for maintenance. Am I wrong? Okay. So hang on. Let me count, Larry. Okay. None. Larry, zero.
Are you people telling me that?
Oh, there's one in the way back. There's one. Perfect. Okay, so we got one loony bin.
One other loony bin.
Larry, have you ever traveled with a fan?
Yes.
You've not in your car, on the plane.
Well, no, not on the plane, but when I got here, the first thing I did after checking in was I went and purchased a fan. So why does everybody look at me so weird?
Because you didn't buy a shower head and channel locks.
This is the weirdest audience I've ever seen.
I know, right? I know.
Now, this is bizarre.
Travel tips with Larry.
Do you have any room for clothes?
No, they're irrelevant. That's what the check baggage is for. Larry does this in the carry-on.
So, now, I have to explain to you. When you're at a hotel, the doors are slamming outside your hall, right? Cars are starting, horns are blowing, trucks are going by, gearing down, and people are talking, and all this extraneous noise. And they also govern the AC. I don't know if you guys have picked up on it here, but these air conditioners are regulated. When you leave your room, regardless of what you've set it in, it jumps up to 74. If you've got it at 68, they don't care. When you leave the room, they've got it where it won't drop below 74. So if you're out all day long, the temperature is 74, 75, and you get back in there. Because there's a sensor that tells them that the computer says there's nobody here. It doesn't need to be 68 degrees. So when I get in my room, I need moving air and I need background noise to drown out all that stuff. So the first thing I did is went and purchased a fan. And when I came in the door, they looked at me like I was nuts carrying a fan in an air-conditioned building.
My room is frigid.
I actually had someone doing this when I was going back here.
Explain to people what that was.
I held up my phone because when I was coming by with my fan, somebody said, look at that crazy guy. And they put it.
And you're asking about the sanity level of the audience. And you're having your picture taken as you're walking into a hotel?
Well, I don't know why they were looking at me so funny.
I can't imagine. Anybody have any ideas? Oh, see, nobody said anything.
Doesn't everybody do that?
Probably should.
Yeah, probably. But you've put one in your bag before?
No, I carry it in the car when I'm driving. I would. There's no point to buy a fan after. I've bought probably 25 fans in my travel career.
And he just leaves them.
Well,
he's left them with me before.
I ask people if they want a fan, but yes, I'm good for the Lasco Fan Company.
Does anybody have any registry, supervision, interstate compact, any questions of that sort that they could drum up to provide us with something to discuss for a brief period of time? Anybody? Come on, anything at all. Why is there a bleep? Fill in the blank.
What does it take to travel from one state to another in your supervision?
Travel or move?
Move.
So you want to actually move. So you want to, and while you're on supervision?
I'm in Florida, which sucks. And I want to move to Georgia, what I have to do?
While you're on supervision?
Yes.
Okay. Larry, go.
You're gonna have to contact. You're on state of Florida supervision. Question: Are you on state of Florida supervision or federal supervision?
State of Florida.
Well, you're gonna have to get your probation supervising officer to initiate a application to Georgia, interstate compact application to Georgia, and there's paperwork, but you can't submit it. They have to do it, and I'd have to check the chart to see if Florida charges an application fee for the privilege of seeing if Georgia will let you live there. But some states, like, we don't charge a fee. We're happy to get rid of them. But some states charge a fee because of it's a service, and somebody's got to pay the cost of that. So it may be as much as $150 to apply to go to Georgia. But Georgia will be given 45 days after that packet arrives to decide if your address fits within any exclusion zones you may be subject to based on, and he can explain this better than I am. There's like various layers of restriction depending on when your crime occurred, that you may have a lot of restrictions on where you can live, or you may have none depending on how old your conviction is.
When was your conviction?
2007.
Okay, you're probably only at like the second tier, because there's four, like 2003, then 2006, 2008, and then some other time when it got horrid. But you would still have some living restrictions, and they'd be in the, now wait, I always get confused, like, is the living restriction part going to come from the sentence of Florida, or is that going to be imposed by Georgia?
While he's on probation, it could be both.
Oh, Jesus. This conversation always makes my head swirl.
So, well, Georgia's registry is going to have whatever restrictions it might have, and you have to follow those. But if Florida put particular conditions in addition to that as a part of your sentence, if the Florida court said you cannot be on certain types of facilities without permission of your probation officer. Well, wouldn't it be a great country if you could just move and that condition would go away? That condition goes with you. So every condition that Florida imposed on you as a part of your sentence goes to Georgia or whatever state you go to. The only thing that Georgia can do is enforce those. And if they're not enforceable in Georgia, then they have to notify Florida that we don't do that here. An example I always use is the polygraph machine. There were times when only a couple states were using polygraphs as a part of sex offender supervision. Almost every state that I'm familiar with now does. It's part of the treatment monitoring. But if you went to a state that required that and the state didn't operate that type of apparatus, as Andy calls the kabuki machine.
Kabuki.
Well, Florida would be notified, we don't do that here. So therefore, you either have to remove that condition or we won't accept your offender. And so there's some conditions, if they're not enforceable, if the state Supreme Court of Georgia said we can't do that here, then Florida would be notified, we can't enforce this condition, you'll have to remove it before we'll accept this offender. But if they don't do that, every Florida condition comes with you, and Georgia can impose supervision conditions in addition to that. But that's only conditions. They can't enlarge your sentence, they can't enlarge your fine, they can't enlarge your restitution. Those are all punitive, but they can add special conditions. For example, a curfew. You may come to Georgia from a state where there were no curfews, and they may say, you've got a 9 p.m. curfew here. And they can do that because it's not enlarging your sentence. You've still got 5 years probation. That doesn't change. But they may tell you, we don't let you roam 24 hours a day. You have a curfew here. And if you don't like that, they say, well, you know, you didn't have to come here. So the question is, 45 days after you apply, they're obligated to give Florida an answer whether they'll take you. If they do accept you, you'll be given instructions of where to report, and you will report there, and a Georgia officer would take control of your case, and everything that Florida required of you will be required in Georgia, unless it's unconstitutional or some reason they can't enforce it. So you won't escape any condition.
I have a question. tell me, how much time do you have left on supervision?
2 years.
Okay. Would you, so for him to apply, he's going to have an address already, correct?
Yes.
And obviously you don't want to pick one that's next to a school, daycare, et cetera, whatever. Do they have to approve you?
They do not.
So can you think of a condition where it would be like mandatory that they accept you?
There would be if he were convicted in Georgia. If he were living in Georgia at the time he did the plea. Some people catch charges in a state they're visiting or they have some connection to, but they weren't really living there. If you could show that you were living in Georgia at the time you were convicted, you'd be mandatory accept case. If you were serving the U.S. military and they repositioned you in Georgia, they'd have to accept you. But it's not likely you're going to be serving the U.S. military with a PFR conviction and remain on active duty. So that's not likely to apply, but those were a couple that come to mind where they would have to accept you.
And so then that obviously leaves the other side where they would reject you for, you have a hair misaligned in your application? I mean, can they just, like, we don't want you here?
Well, technically they can't do that. There's the reality that states like mine, they look very hard to turn you down for any reason. But some states actually are not as bad as mine, where they'll actually give you a fair shake. And if you have a good plan of supervision, if you've got a connection, stable residence, you're not within an exclusion zone, they'll accept you. But my state, when somebody applies, they go out with a fine-tooth comb. They'll check the person's background. They'll surveil their house and see if they can find anything that would justify turning down that person's request for transfer. And they do not want you to come there. And
Now, Uncle Larry, advice for me. I would like you to tell me, if I had 2 years left on supervision, would you recommend that I transfer my supervision to another state? Me. There's nobody here in the audience. Can you, we're on a phone call. Would you recommend that I do an interstate compact transfer with 2 years left?
Well, it would depend on what your supervision was like in your current state, what your rapport was. If you had an excellent relationship and you had a relatively high level of freedom and stable job, I would say don't risk it. If you had bad opportunity in a minimum wage job and you had stronger support system in a new state and better opportunity, I would say consider it. You got nothing to lose. They're gunning for you anyway. If they're gunning for you, are they gunning for you where you are?
Chris.
Are they gunning for you where you are, or do you have a stable supervision?
Pretty stable. I'm making the point with the 2 years because you're going to be at least 45 days into it before you know. Prior to that, you will have to do some level of due diligence to know whether you can live, can you find a place where you can go, and all that, you know, 1,000-foot restrictions, whatever else will apply. You have to figure all that out. Can you secure the address, meaning you will have to rent it, or do you have people living there already that will take you in? All of that stuff, you're going to have to do all that legwork first to then get the application done. I'm thinking you're 6-ish months into this process by the time you would actually get the response. And now you only have 18 months left. It's just my thought process. And then I wanted to know, but if you had 10 years left, well, then it's an entirely different equation. Well, but 2 years sounds kind of short.
Where are you thinking of going in Georgia? That'll tell me a little bit about...
Yep. Oh, boy. Okay. Larry, have fun.
Where the heck? Where did he say?
Montezuma is going to be very rural. Very.
Where is that?
Montezuma is going to... Montezuma's out, population, let's say 1,000. Halfway between like Warner Robins and Columbus, in that ballpark. Maybe even southwest. Andersonville? In that kind of general vicinity.
Where are you in Florida?
I'm in southwest Florida.
More specific. I don't know particularly, but if I were going to transfer to Georgia, it would be an urban center where they have too many to keep track of and not enough resources to track them. I wouldn't go to a rural area where they have plenty of resources to track folks. So that's just my thought process. We've had a lot of people from Georgia, and one here sitting had a relatively pleasant experience, but a lot of people, we had one move from New York to Georgia and wasn't so lucky.
I wouldn't say he had a retaking. He canceled his interstate transfer deal from New York and went back. They were gunning for him. He was going to go down to like the southeast area near Savannah, but the not populated parts of. And his brother was going to buy a house and he was going to move in there. And they were building, and the sheriff went out to the neighborhood and started knocking on doors and asking about just different things in the neighborhood. And knocked on the builder's door and said, I'm doing, you know, checking out what's around and how things are. I'm doing this because a PFR is going to move into this neighborhood. And they built a park in the developing neighborhood to prevent him from moving there.
Now, you have to admit that's funny.
That's funny. And then did it again. And he got there and they just gave him hell. Just completely gave him hell. So then as a third attempt, I got him an address with a friend. Now, Larry, I got a quick question for you. Friend of mine owns a house. He's a PFR. just about to finish supervision. He has two roommates, both of them PFRs that he rents to. Plausible?
So far, so good.
All right. Well, I mean, the likelihood of that being something that is allowed in your state, let's say.
Well, if they were not supervised PFRs, there'd be nothing could be done about it. But if they were supervised, they would never allow that.
What about the one that's on supervision, though? The one that's owning the house on supervision, then living...
It would never be allowed if he was under supervision.
So he is then a PFR transferring from another state, and my friend is the PFR that owns the house, and there are three PFRs living in one house in Augusta, Georgia.
They would never tolerate that.
So now he's back in New York, where the conditions in New York are significantly better. Also, he had a problem with the attitude of Georgia in general versus being in, like, New York City. Not way out in the boonies of New York, because New York's a big place. I do have a question from someone in the live stream chat, because we are live streaming on our Discord server. All right, I have a question. This is from PA Dad. I have a friend who applied for interstate compact transfer from Arizona to Pennsylvania. His offense was decades ago, and he's off parole and probation, completed treatment and assessed low risk, and is blind and disabled, but Arizona has lifetime CSL?
Community supervision for life.
All right. That's kind of redundant. Lifetime CSL? All right. Arizona approved his transfer, but PA parole officer denied him because they said they would have to enforce Arizona residency restrictions. But PA has no residency restrictions. Is there any way to appeal the decision? And as an extra note, he has family in PA, SS disability income, and owns a home in PA next door to his sister, who is his medical caregiver since his mom died. The residency restrictions are not a condition of his parole, just the Arizona state law. Is that enough information?
That is very confusing. So it's not a CSL condition, correct?
I think he's, so Arizona, his offense was decades ago and he's off parole and probation. So his residency restrictions would just be part of the registry, and Pennsylvania has no. But why would they then, they said they would have to enforce Arizona residency restrictions.
I'll answer it both ways. If it's a registry condition, it doesn't make a damn, because that doesn't go with him. Arizona's registry is out the window. If it's a condition of CSL, community supervision, that does go with him.
Okay. And so, would there be a way for him to fight that?
That's tricky, because the CSL is usually imposed as a matter of law and not by the judge. If it were a judicial imposed condition, you would ask the judge in Arizona to lift that condition, because he's no longer here. And I would think that any competent attorney would be able to go into the sentencing court and say, got a client, he's going to be out of here. He's not going to be perving in this state. He's going to be perving.
I'm sorry, what, Larry? I'm sorry, can you go back? They're not going to be doing what?
Perving.
Okay, I'm sorry. I needed to get clarity on this word for the transcription, of course. All right, please continue. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Sorry. I'm sorry.
So, well, this is actually the way it would go down. I mean, you probably wouldn't use the term perving, but you would... But you would go have a conversation with the prosecution, and you'd say, look, I've got this old case from way back. He's on CSL. And would you stipulate to an order to where we're going to take this condition off, because he's going to be no threat to us. He's going to be, if he's a threat to anyone, he's going to be a threat in Pennsylvania. So let's enter a stipulation that this is lifted, and then we can get him out of here, and he won't be our problem anymore. That's what you would do. But if it's imposed as a matter of law, I don't believe an Arizona judge could lift that. So then he would have to go, I think, in a Pennsylvania court and say that the condition of CSL that's statutorily in Arizona law is not enforceable in Pennsylvania. The problem he's going to have trying to do that is, if I'm the Pennsylvania authorities, I'm going to say, nope, this is not this controversy is not ripe for review. He's not here yet. When he gets here, we'll think about this. We don't want to deal with this. I'm not going to write a brief about this, Your Honor. I'm going to say it's like the IML challenge. It wasn't ready yet when it was filed, in my opinion. If I'm the responding party, I'm going to say that this is not ripe. And I'm going to make him work to prove that he should have judicial review in our state, because he's not here, Your Honor. This is a hypothetical. He might come here someday. And of course, the other side is going to say, well, he's wanting to come here, but he can't here. And well, that's not our problem. When he gets here, we'll talk about this, Judge. So it's going to be you're going to have an extraordinarily gifted attorney to figure out how to get this in the judiciary where they'll actually entertain.
I have no idea what you guys are telling me with time. Time? Time out?
No, Larry has a reminder.
Oh. Oh! You could have interrupted that. No. So so you have to do the 24-hour reserve your position. You don't pay the $40 to get in line?
You know I'm too cheap to do that.
I do know that. I do know that.
I haven't bought a meal since I've been here.
Okay. Yes. You have a question. Please, as much volume, you're a very soft-spoken woman, please as much volume as you can.
Okay. How's this?
So far, so good.
Good. So my question is, how is it that, based on our discussion, Florida can re-adjudicate your offense, your charges, when you move from another state, which is what they did for me, in my state of offense, my offense was a misdemeanor, and my registration would have expired automatically in 10 years. When I moved to Florida, they re-adjudicated it as a felony, and in Florida, I have to stay on the registry forever. How are they able to do that?
Misdemeanor conviction, another state moves to Florida, and now you're on the registry for life.
I didn't hear the whole question. I was checking in.
I know. I got that. And you got a really crappy position. Larry's going to be in the back of the bus. He's going to be sitting by the bathrooms between two large humans, and he's going to be in the middle seat with no armrests.
So
C10.
So now we're having a real-time example. I was too cheap to pay the $25, and I checked in 1 minute after they opened check-in, and I'm in the C group. So it didn't pan out for me. That flight is sold out. There's not going to be an open seat, and they may be even oversold, but go ahead.
I got B4, by the way, Larry. B4.
So you're fine.
I'm good.
Okay, so the question again.
The question again is this. So in the context of our discussion about interstate compact moves, how is it that Florida can re-adjudicate your conviction when you move from one state where the offense was, as a misdemeanor, and in that state, if you remain there, your registration would expire automatically at 10 years. And you move to Florida, and then they say that was a felony. And because it's a felony, you have to remain on the registry forever. How are they able to do that?
Well, I'll answer it, but have you ever asked Gil Shaffnet this question? He was here.
I have asked Gil Shaffnet this question.
So, and he answered?
He said, ask Paul Dubling. He did. Did you? I did.
And Paul Dubling said?
He said, why would Gil say that? That conversation happened today.
So you got circled.
I got the circle. I did. So.
Well.
The buck stops here, Larry.
Contrary to your belief, they did not re-adjudicate your case. Your FBI record still says you're convicted of a misdemeanor. Florida can never change that. You're a misdemeanor.
But on their paperwork, they say only what they say counts, per them.
But your FBI record, you are convicted of a misdemeanor. That will never change unless there's a goof up in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And Florida is the reporting, the state of conviction is the reporting. The FBI's conviction records are based on the state, the organization, the law enforcement entity that reported it. What Florida has done is they have determined how to correlate your out-of-state conviction for registration purposes. And that's all. And they may say that had you done that here, it would have been a felony, but it's not a felony. It will never become a felony.
Amen to that, brother.
It will always be a misdemeanor. But it's the same thing if you take your vehicle from New Mexico, where we don't require you to have a smog inspection, and you take it to that liberal, lefty, pointy-headed place where he lives, where they inspect everything and collect massive fees of $200 or whatever it is. They don't give a damn about what New Mexico did. You're there now. So Florida gets to classify you for regulatory reasons however they like. If you don't like it, you don't have to live there.
More
specifically, they haven't changed they've just determined how to classify you. I don't know Florida's classification translation system. In New Mexico, we would do the same thing. We would first determine if your conduct would have constituted a sexual offense if you were in Georgia and made obscene phone calls to a minor, that would be a registrable sex offense. You wouldn't have to register in New Mexico if you made those obscene phone calls in Georgia. We would look at that and say, well, obscene phone calls, that's great. We don't register that. So you'd be done with the registry. And they would send you a notice saying you don't longer have to register.
And so she could then leave Florida, move back to where she came from, and then she would no longer be on the registry in Florida?
Well, no, she would be still listed. As I understand it, Florida doesn't take you off the list. But being on the list is not the same thing as being registered. And I get all sorts of boos and hisses when I say that.
Ooh.
But when you're listed on a website, you're not subject to residency restrictions, employment restrictions, reporting obligations, fingerprints, butt prints, DNA, all that stuff goes away. You're listed in perpetuity with the last photograph they have, the last address they knew, and that is inconvenient. You'd rather it not happen, but you can't be prosecuted for failure to give an internet update of those 52 things. Florida has no more say-so in your life. That's a permanent record of something that did happen. But you are not registered. You are listed. So, but that irritates the... Okay.
So let's say you do want to get out of Dodge, you want to move out of Florida, and which felony or misdemeanor, if you move to another state, what are they going to see you at? Because they're going to do their own little reclassification. If I move to a state like Washington State, are they going to consider me a felon?
Because you're not a felon. Okay. You're not a felon. You're a lifetime registrant. That's not
so they go by the FBI card.
Well, they're going to look at the offense of the state of where you were convicted.
Okay, so they go by the
but
state
we don't care whether it's a felony or misdemeanor in that state. We care about what it would be in our state. So we're going to look at A, is that a sexual offense that would require registration? And B, if it is, which one of our offenses on the list does it compare to?
Okay.
Most closely. Compared to, because our law says it has to be one of our offenses or an equivalent, not substantially similar. That's the more common language, but ours says equivalent. So we look at what's it equivalent to. We don't care whether it's a felony or misdemeanor or not. We care about which sexual offense it's equivalent to. But we don't make you a felon if you're not a felon. We make you an equivalent to one of our offenses, and we'll say you're a 10-year or you're a lifetime. That's the only two possibilities you're going to be. You can never be, we also have a 20-year category, but I don't think you could ever be a 20-year. The only way you could be a 20-year in New Mexico would be if you were off all obligations related to your sentence, your punishment had concluded by June 30th of 2005. Had you paid all your debt in full by June 30th, 2005, yes or no? Had you finished your sentence by June 30th, 2005, all obligations, not the registration, but all... Okay, so you could never be a 20-year. You could only be a 10-year or a lifetime. So that's what we would figure out is, do you compare to one of our 10-year offenses or do you compare to one of our lifetime? We don't get involved in whether you're a felon or not. Neither are they. They're just telling you that the offense that it most substantially similar or close to happens to be a felony. But that doesn't make it a felony in the state of conviction. It's still a misdemeanor.
So would the best course of action to be to contact a very competent attorney in this field to find out what Washington State or any other state I might go to would consider my offense?
You got money to burn?
Not to burn, but
well, that's what you're going to do is burn it, because most of the lawyers are going to be guessing. You've already described a buck passing that went through two very competent lawyers.
I know somebody that's competent that can help you.
Why would you expect anything different? You went through two very competent lawyers, and they pointed.
It did happen, and I like both.
But you're asking the person that can help you.
Who was that?
I promise you. Okay, well, we're going to move on. There is a question. I'm going to read your question, but there's no way that this is going to pass, and I'm going to need clarification. So... And we're already at 55 minutes. I thought we would only be here for like 40 minutes, but this is moving along, so we'll continue just for a little bit. But anyway, just letting you know. So the question is, first of all, my voice is shot, so I can't talk much. But has Larry ever heard of any Supreme Court that has gone to conference a dozen times and was denied? Does this mean that it may give some merit if tweaked? I don't understand.
Probably need some clarification.
All right.
So basically, a friend of mine that I was incarcerated with, he took a Supreme, his case to the Supreme Court. It was a BFR case. And I can't remember what exactly it was. But it went to conference, I think, 15 times. And they eventually did not. But in your opinion, does that mean if somebody said, okay, and read the opinion, it's like, well, I don't agree with that. But if they read it and said, if we change this or maybe add it to this, do you think it would have a potential maybe to be reconsidered? Not that case, but the argument maybe.
Well,
I know most cases don't go to conference one time, let alone 15.
I have never heard of a case, the same cert petition. You're saying the same petition went to conference.
When I looked at that docket earlier today, it had at least 12 different conference schedules.
But how many times was it actually conferenced? Yeah, because Paul Dubling would probably be a better, because he clerked at the Tenth Circuit, which is just one level below the Supreme Court. But I'm not familiar with a case. It goes to conference and it has the four votes or it doesn't to grant cert. And if it has three votes, cert's denied. If it has four votes or more, cert is granted.
So there's really no way of telling what the vote was for each conference unless it was just granted cert.
Well, if it doesn't have the four, it's going to get that one line order that the petition for certiorari has been denied. But I've never heard of one going multiple times. I've heard of, like you said, rescheduling and asking for additional clarity, but I've never heard of them conferencing 14 times on one case. So I think Paul's probably a better person to ask that to than I am, because I don't have that life experience of clerking for the Court of Appeals, much less the Supreme Court.
And who did he clerk for?
The Tenth Circuit.
But there was a...
Gorsuch.
Also, yeah, he clerked. That's what I wanted to hear. He clerked for Neil Gorsuch.
So.
Let's start to wrap things up. I have a little bit... We'll do this. I guess we can do this off the air about... I have some prizes for some people. Do you have anybody here in the audience that may or may not be your fiancé?
Oh, I always have. Every time I'm here.
Okay. Can we expose? Can we reveal?
Well, I have at least one, maybe two here tonight.
It's an ongoing joke. Larry, I would like to add that in spite of our disagreements at times, I very much appreciate the 270 plus episodes that we've actually done. I think you are phenomenally intelligent, educated, amazing. And out of all of the people here, all of the presenters, the PhDs, you have the most unique gift to explain these things, to articulate them, to understand them at this unbelievably detailed level, which then also allows you to make this spaghetti bowl of strategy to work your way around this way, around this way, around this way, and you do some verbal legal jujitsu on your opponents and beat them to death. So, and I share that with you. There it is, thank you. But I say that as an announcement to anybody in the audience that is unfamiliar with who Larry is, that if you have questions, we do this podcast every week, except for here and there. And that's what we're here for. I'm off the registry, I'm done, but I continue to do this because one of my favorite sayings is the reason why we are here is because the people before us couldn't or wouldn't do the things necessary to make things better for those of us that are now coming up. And it's a fight. And I mean, somebody was saying, don't use that kind of language. It's something that we have to work towards.
Struggle.
Fair enough. And so that's why we're here. And Larry's also not directly impacted by this anymore, but here we are. And this is what we do every week. Larry picks out cases, figures out the weirdest way to come up with a gun rights case that how that relates to the registry. I don't even remember what your ultimate argument was, but that's what we do, and sometimes there's a case that we can talk about directly. And I deeply invite all of you to come join. It's registrymatters.co. There's patreon.com/registrymatters if you feel generous enough to support us as well on our endeavor to educate and change the world. Sorry?
Discord.
Oh, there's also Discord, which is a whole lot of fun. You're in there. already. But you're not in there now. And you're in there too. And there are three people listening to us do this all right now as well.
So would you like me to announce who my three fiancés are?
Yes, please.
So there's...
you can just point. I don't want to call anybody out.
So don't want to call anybody out.
Use a fake name.
So, well, there's Margaret Hoover.
Right.
Does anybody know who Margaret Hoover is?
The great, 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 great granddaughter of?
President Herbert Hoover.
And then number two?
She hosts a weekly program on PBS called Firing Line that used to be hosted by William Buckley Jr. So that's fiance number one. And then there's a couple here at the conference.
Okay. All right. We don't want to help them?
No.
All right. Very well.
Because they're still married, but they don't know that they're getting a divorce.
I got it. Very well. Thank you all very much for joining us this week for Registry Matters episode 270. I have no idea where I'll get the time to edit this and produce it because we have to do all the teardown tomorrow and then I have a flight. But thank you all very much. I appreciate everyone attending. And then a great round of applause.
You've been listening to FYP.
We still have almost 200 people.
You've been listening to FYP.